thank you so much for coming to talk about metadata so early in the morning. Not everybody would do that. So thank you very much. I'm actually going to let each of the panelists introduce themselves and their companies.
Hi, I'm Amanda. I am a bibliographic metadata consultant. I work within the publishing industry. I've been in the publishing industry for a while with publishers like HarperCollins and Dundurn and House of Financy and Groundwood Press. I left recently to help all publishers. I work with metadata for publishers and consortiums like Ebound, as well as for self-published authors. So the whole spectrum of metadata within books, specifically.
Hi, my name is Tessa Sproul, and I am the co-founder and co-CEO of a company called Vubble, where we build solutions for mainly broadcast media organizations to distribute their video content using machine learning. I spent 20 years at the CBC, mostly in journalism side, then progressively more leadership management positions at the CBC. I left in 2014 when I was the director of digital, because I just found that for the information economy, most media organizations had abdicated responsibility for digital distribution to outside platforms such as Twitter and Facebook and YouTube, and that I found was deeply problematic for an information economy upon which, you know, democracies are based on people having valid information in front of them. So this is all before 2016 and all that stuff. So have been through a lot since then, and I'm really excited to talk about metadata. I know it's it is early, but it's one of my favorite things to talk about.
Hi, I'm Tom Layton. I'm the director of digital at Anthem Entertainment and oversee our digital services part of the business, which includes our YouTube MCN, digital royalty collections, and our digital distribution arm for our label division. So I kind of see metadata across all of our various music business divisions. So yeah, great to be here.
And just a little bit more background on me. I've hopped around as a consultant and employee within the music industry, so the recording side at the beginning, and now in the music publishing sector, which have very different metadata needs. And then popped into books at Access Copyright for 5 years, managing their operations. So that's where I'm coming from. I also just was recently told and met the person. And my very first job, my job was to give out the very first ISRC in Canada, which is the International Standard Recording Code for the recording industry. And I met Bonnie Fedro, who's now at Actoraction. She said, you know, when I was at Warner, you gave me the very first code ever. So historic moment. So could each of you just talk about the industries you work with and the importance of metadata in that industry, or some of the issues that you're seeing?
Okay. I'm sitting to the left of you, so I'll start, if you don't mind. So I do work in book publishing, and I think books have been working with metadata very well for a very long time. In book publishing, for those of you who don't know, we do have a metadata standard. It's called Onyx. It's how we communicate the information about our books, and that's been in play for decades, and we're all pretty good at it now. But even before that, data about books, a book description, their jacket copy, the author name, we've been communicating that for as long as we've been printing books. So we've really figured out this metadata thing. Now, I can't say that all of us are super great at it, but the standards are there, the information is out there, and as long as we follow those standards and work with what's in place, we have a great way to communicate information about books to everybody who needs that information. And that standard is being constantly updated. So as long as you're paying attention to it, you can do really, really super well in metadata in books. I'm really proud of the publishing industry's use of metadata. I think we're doing very well. So you can all, if you're in book publishing, give yourself a pat on the back. There are still challenges. We move forward quite quickly within that standard, so you do have to keep up to date. But getting that information out there is something that we're pretty good at.
Awesome. You guys have your stuff together.
Oh, we really do. Yeah, we're great.
So I focus largely in the video space, short form video, information video. So it could be stuff on YouTube. It could be things that are published by, you know, more legacy media organizations like The Guardian or CBC, something like that. It is a dog's breakfast, I got to tell you, with video. It is all over the map. There is an international standard called IPTC, which is used by publishers. Largely, it's newspaper-oriented, so it doesn't really deal well with short-form video content. When I left CBC in 2014, we spent a year talking to library scientists and data scientists, people trying to figure out what is a good standard for treating video. And I'm not talking about like movies where you have a lot of time, and you're like, you've got a pretty set number of variables of the people involved and all that stuff. I'm talking about like the piece about, you know, the latest Brexit stuff or something from Britain. How do you actually create meaningful data around that content for distribution via machine learning was the problem that we were trying to address. So we've cracked that pretty well, I would say. We're being used by CTV News as our biggest client here in Canada. And they came to us saying that very thing. They said, listen, we know that broadcast is not the way that we're going to be reaching the audiences of the future. As a matter of fact, like by 2022, we think we're probably only going to be in broadcast with live news and live sports. So how do we get our stuff seen by other people not relying on Facebook and Google? Because let's face it, Facebook and Google, they have some data. But for the most part, the publishing distribution signal that is used by their systems is popularity. And that's pretty much exclusively the signal that is used by those platforms for distribution. There's a few others. We can talk about that. So we wanted to crack into what are the meaningful signals that a publisher in the space of trying to inform a public could use for the distribution of their content. And we also build tools for them for that distribution of that content. The biggest challenges, you guys are well aware of what the challenges are. There's been a way too heavy, I would say, and I'm right, I would say the pendulum has swung way too far towards technology solving the problem of distribution. So when you hear from the platforms, it's like, oh, you know, it's just our algorithm went a little bit crazy when it suggested that thing to you. Sorry about that. It's always a blame the technology. There's very little human intervention or human accountability when things go wrong. So if you remember when Notre Dame was burning on YouTube, they had live news feeds from credible news organizations of the burning of the cathedral. And YouTube's algorithm started to suggest information about 9/11 because the machine could not tell the difference between two burning spires and 9/11. And that, to me, is a journalist would be fired on the spot for making that kind of error. And this was, oh, well, that's just technology being funny. Not funny, especially when you're talking about information content that is incredibly important that we understand how it's getting to people and why it's getting to people in the way that it is. And I say to my folks that we're potentially working with or the folks that we are working with, if you are using AI for the distribution of your news and information content from your newsroom and you don't know how it works, you're not doing it right. So there's a whole lot of stuff in terms of challenges in my space, but there's great opportunity too. I think my company and others, I'm starting to see people trying to inject the human side back into it, because I think that is something that humans do really well, is the human judgment piece in this. And that's what our whole system is based on. We start very manually. We actually have human editors codifying video content for our clients. And people are like, well, that can't scale. It can if you have a certain number of videos that have been codified by humans. So we worked with Seneca this past year to create an algorithm to make recommendations to our editors of what categories are in a piece of content. And that's gone really well. It's about 36% accuracy, which is incredibly strong. It's 10% better than random. And that it's strong because it's actually better than what Google can do right now. You know, like they're motivated by putting ads in front of stuff. They're not, you've heard about like how they can identify dogs in videos. They have one of the things that you can use in machine learning is libraries of assets as a training set for your algorithm that you're gonna build. There is this heavily weighted towards dogs because they happen to have a lot of people with dogs in the office that work on it. Our own like biases are implicit in these algorithms. That's a huge challenge. And how much we rely on them without knowing how they're functioning is the biggest challenge. So we're trying to be as transparent as possible, allow windows into how these systems work. And that's one of the reasons that I'm here too, to be incredibly transparent and talk about how it works.
Yeah, so for the music industry and music publishing specifically, obviously metadata is incredibly important. It ensures our writers are paid accurately and timely, our artists are paid correctly, You know, there's a ton of data that goes along the music distribution chain, from ISWC codes, which are unique identifiers for compositions, to ISRC codes for sound recordings, the linkage of, you know, composers to artists who wrote the song versus who performed the song. You know, so for our industry, it's incredibly important to build a good foundation of metadata and data in general, so that you can distribute, collect, and register your works with the various, you know, international bodies that work with our company. So incredibly important. And then also, you know, there's tons of challenges. When I came into the music industry, you know, there's huge issues around data that publishers had. You know, there's a lack of data for the most part, and then digital services were trying to, you know, get this data to populate their systems, and a lot of people just didn't have it. But over the past 5 years, I've seen huge strides in terms of, you know, publishers, like labels, music industry bodies building out their databases, populating metadata, coming up with international codes. Obviously now DDEX is being rolled out, which will be really important over the next 10 years. And yeah, so there's still a lot of issues. Of duplication is a huge issue, duplication of data, too much data. Also, you know, your system is only as good as the partners that you're working with. So some people are further along the chain of improving their systems and their metadata. And, you know, so there's still a lot of work to be done ahead. But yeah, data is incredibly important, and metadata is going to, you know, keep being a huge driver of success for the music industry. Yeah.
And just to comment on that, I think the book industry did it right in terms of always having centralized databases, so no duplication. But to the extent of the recording companies not getting around to putting databases together until 2 years ago, the music publishing is much more centralized and quite a bit better than the recording side. But from my viewpoint, that has been a flaw. So we're going to talk a little bit more about the problems before we get into solutions. So we keep hearing about AI and blockchain and metadata and how wonderful all these things are. Can you talk a little bit more about what your clients or your companies are experiencing in terms of the problems with metadata and the technology around it?
Did you want to talk about
it, since that's what you do? Sure. So I won't name the companies, but I would say the digital distribution has been, particularly in the media space, in the media industry, it's been really competitive, right? Like, digital has disrupted everything about how information media essentially is distributed and how people make money on it or from it and advertise within it. So there's a whole lot of competing issues that are in that. And because it's like this disruptive force, it was ignored by most media organizations. I was just in Athens at a conference called the Gen Summit last week, and it's all these publishers and media organizations, mostly European. And, you know, everybody is feeling this pain. BBC, they're like, I don't know. How do I have meaningful information, metadata around my content? How do I get it in front of people who I can no longer rely to sit down on a couch and use a remote control to access my channel, but are getting it from wherever they're getting it? And it's all over the map. Like, the Germans were there, and they're like, we have this figured out. But that was it. They're the only ones that said that they had it all figured out. And I'm not sure that they did. There's a lot of promises made from technology first companies saying, oh, just give me your library and I'll take it in and it'll be like awesome. We'll have these amazing sausages that come out. And again, do not let the pendulum swing that far to the side, especially around information content. There's a reason that ads show up on YouTube in front of ISIS videos, because Google's algorithm cannot identify a beheading video. And that's a huge problem, obviously, for all kinds of reasons. But thinking of it just as a technological solution is deeply problematic, because even those companies, the big platforms, they won't tell you this overtly, but they employ thousands and thousands and thousands of people to tag, to data tag their content as well. And these are real people doing this, probably paid very little. and they don't have the context, right? So this is why things like Napalm Girl image in Facebook was considered child pornography, because the person who was in the content moderation side that got that as an image, I don't know if you remember, this is about two summers ago, you know, a Pulitzer Prize winning image that changed the world when it was published on the front of every newspaper during the Vietnam War and largely probably helped end it, was pulled down because first the algorithm did flag it, and then it went to a content moderation farm, I think probably one in Bangladesh, and then somebody said, no, this is a naked child, so this is child pornography, and it contravenes the terms and conditions. So this is where the problem lies, where, you know, we over-rely absolutely for the technology to fix things. And I insist that there has to be human intervention in this stuff right now, especially as we're building the foundations. Mm-hmm. Like, this industry in particular is really slow into it, but as we're building the bedrock for how these systems work, we have to do it with meaningful thought. No one on Facebook, no one at the upper level of Facebook came from a marketing or journalistic background. And this is why we have a lot of the challenges that we do today with those platforms in particular.
In publishing, the problem with that pendulum swing isn't quite so dramatic, but it is there. If you don't have somebody check, I should say book publishing, if you don't have somebody checking your data, a human, it will go wrong, especially in small Canadian presses. You can't afford the sort of AI systems, even if they were there, you can't afford them in such a way that they could help. Because we are all entering our metadata, our bibliographic metadata, into these databases and then spitting it out and sending it out to the world in code, it's hitting Amazon, for example, and immediately going live. And then whatever you entered or whatever your system entered is going up there. I heard a horror story, I won't name the publisher, of a publisher who missed they were setting prices. And this was a digital book, an ebook. So they were selling it in Japan, and they didn't read the list of their currencies, and they priced it at 4 yen, which you can't even buy a piece of candy for 4 yen. That's like it's a ridiculous price. So they sold a ton of copies of this book and made essentially $2 after selling thousands of copies because it was so cheap, because somebody entered it in, nobody checked. No system on the other end is going, hey, hold on a second, that seems really cheap. Are you sure about that? It just went up live and there it is. And if it takes 5 days to pull that data back down, that's 5 days worth of sales that you've messed up, essentially. And we run into that a lot in bibliographic metadata. It's a lot of small human errors compounding when an AI system isn't there, isn't catching them, isn't flagging them for whatever reason. So you do have to be careful. We do still need human intervention, I think, is really important.
Yeah, and the AI systems, like, our approach is manual first. So have enough of those patterns where you start to realize, oh, this is where the human error is happening around pricing or people, you know, then you can actually use AI, but do it that way rather than starting with, oh, let's see what happens. There's a great story about, I'll probably get this wrong, but there's a lab at MIT where they're trying to figure out how to grow like the most intensely flavored basil on the planet so that you can have less farming and all the agricultural issues that are associated with mass production of things. But anyway, so really smart people, botanists, intersection of AI and botany, and how do you genetically modify plants to have more intense flavors. Really interesting idea. The guy's like, I'm really behind this guy who's leading this. He's like, this is fantastic because, you know, it's almost infinite, the number of possibilities that can happen in the, you know, in botany and how plants germinate. I'm using the wrong language. Botanists would kill me. But he said the very first thing that their AI recommended, he said there were lots of great things that it did, but the very first thing that it recommended was to turn off all the lights. So I was like, wait a minute, what? So it can be, but you just want to have that human intervention into it and understand how these systems are working. Because if you don't understand, in the media space, like I said earlier, popularity is the number one signal that's used by systems. And you know, popularity is defined on Facebook, the angry button actually is one of the key drivers of popularity. If there's enough stuff making people angry, it will go viral on that platform in particular, because anger is like in the back of our brains, in our deepest, you know, psychological lizard brain. Anger is the one thing that gets us really riled and talking and sharing our own stuff. And then with a innocuous system like technology on Facebook, It just sees that as activity. Oh, popular, popular. Oh, it would be more popular if I throw this at it, you know? And so that's deeply problematic in this space. So, yeah, the human intervention pieces.
So, Tom, can you talk a little bit more about the problems you're encountering within and music and music publishing?
Yeah, and I'll echo the same sentiments, right? Like, automation will only get you so far, and I think it's really important to start with a manual process. I mean, especially for the music industry, coming from a lot of legacy systems and legacy databases, you know, we've had a pretty lengthy process of going through our entire database and, you know, making sure all the data conforms properly. There's a proper syntax. You know, we have everything tagged appropriately so that we can then build off that to, you know, implement the new standards that are being rolled out, so like DDEX. And now, you know, with the Music Modernization Act and the Mechanical Licensing Collective, like, it's that much more important to make sure that your data lines up, that way that you can deliver and interact with these new agencies in, you know, an efficient way. And, you know, we see a lot of things happening with metadata too, even in, you know, Spotify's algorithmic playlists. You know, it's all metadata driven, it's all algorithmic driven, and, you know, it's still got a ways to go. Like, the Discover Weekly playlist is very, very cool, and you know, I'll find stuff I like in there, but, you know, if you go on a weird tangent and listen to a bunch of stuff that you haven't in years, like, all of a sudden, like, that Discover Weekly playlist will start recommending you things you just don't want every week. So, I mean, there's this issue with almost too much metadata and data sometimes, too. And you see that on YouTube all the time, good and bad ways. You know, and even, like, tags now on YouTube videos aren't super relevant. Like, YouTube's algorithm doesn't really factor in tags on your videos, whereas that used to be, you know, a huge, huge thing years ago. You'd have to tag your videos, and you try and, like, mimic your competitors and what tags they had on their videos to try and, like, score higher and go viral. But that's kind of being replaced. So, you know, the music business is coming a long way, but there's going to be a lot of, like, really interesting opportunities coming up, too, with, you know, smart speakers, you know, the way that you can include different types of metadata, like, you know, Friday, beach, weekend, party, like, all that kind of stuff is going to be really cool for smart speakers and the future of, you know, how you play music. So that's cool. But and again, you're only as good as the systems you're working with. So if your partners, especially in foreign territories, don't have implemented data standards or metadata standards, it's going to be really hard to work with them. It's about knowing who, I guess, your partners are, what data they require, what if there's defined international standards, and trying to get your data to a point where it conforms and that you can work together.
Yeah. And I just want to comment that Anthem works not only with music content, but with the scores and the compositions on film and television and other screen-based content. So that's really important to understand. I'm going to switch it a little bit. I think I want to talk about all the companies out in the audience and companies you work with. So let's go a little bit more positive on the what we can do around solutions. And if you're talking to individual creators or you're talking to companies in the creative industries, this is about discoverability and this is about getting paid. So we're looking at those two different things. What advice would you give to people when they're starting out in terms of trying to make sure they get paid and there's discoverability using metadata? Do you want to start? So
we tend to work with larger media organizations that have really vast libraries, but the number one thing I would say to them when they start, and also it would apply to smaller organizations too, is that you're not boiling the ocean. Don't be overwhelmed. It's not everything that you do. In our space, like, I mean, if you're in book publishing, I get it that you want to do everything, but in the news and information space, you know, we do about 10 to 20% of a library of a media organization, because most of it in my world is like the bouncing ball of news stuff. So we're not going to go and like do deep tagging on a piece that will not be relevant 3 hours from now. So we really focus on, in our space, it's between 10 and 25% of a media organization's library that I would say deserves to be codified. So don't be overwhelmed, first of all, by us saying, "Oh, codify everything."
Yeah.
Exactly. I would I would say the most important thing to do is build a very solid foundation. If you're a small business, or you know, you're just getting going, make sure that you start slow, talk to your partners, understand what their data needs are and metadata needs, if there's standards that have been rolled out. Get the foundation of your software systems, your data systems, your software architecture, like get everything set up so that you can move forward and scale appropriately. Kind of walk before you run, because if you introduce tons of bad data or metadata errors or do something wrong, it's a huge process to kind of go backwards and fix everything later. So it's better to do it right and do it right the first time than it is to kind of, you know, try and implement, you know, bad data standards and then try and fix it later. That's my advice.
In book publishing, of course, there's really no way that you could, unless you're starting a new book publishing company right now, you are making metadata. Even if it's just a spreadsheet and you're doing an Excel grid that you're sending to your distributor, that is metadata. So you've already started doing it. But my advice toward making sure that you're doing it properly, make sure there's somebody who owns it. Someone in your organization, and I know we're small and you're scrappy and it's hard, but there has to be someone who knows that they own the metadata, knows that they have the power to make the changes when they want, knows that they have the time to do the research to figure out what needs to be done moving forward in metadata. Don't spread it out across the organization. Give it to somebody who can feel in control of it, because just like Tom said, you want to do it right and you want to do it right the first time. If something gets entered that's incorrect and shows up on Amazon, it can take weeks to pull that information down. That's scary. It's really scary. So have that person who is in charge of making sure it's perfect and give them the time and the space to work on that. I know that's so hard, but metadata is so important.
Yeah, I've got a good example would be, you know, in the past when we were distributing a major release, a number of years ago. I think we had duplicated an ISRC code, just sent the wrong ISRC code to distributors, so it hit like Spotify, Apple Music, YouTube, wherever else, with the wrong ISRC. So just that one slip of metadata basically totally screwed up the entire payment chain. You know, the wrong artist was paid, the wrong release was paid, we had to claw back royalties, we had to explain to the artist like why his royalty statement was wrong. So like, have one person own the creation of the metadata, because if you have too many people, you know, sharing a spreadsheet or shared logins, it can become like a really huge nightmare really quickly, especially if you're dealing with releases or content that generates a lot of money quickly. Especially with music, how like, you know, a lot of the money that's generated now in pop music too is generated like very quickly off the release. So having good metadata is super important.
And then once you've got somebody who owns it and someone who is making sure that it's clean, that person can start enhancing it. And that's where it becomes really fun. Now it's no longer just about who wrote the book, who wrote the song, what's it about. Now they can start looking at things like adding keywords to your popular titles, changing promotional pricing, playing with things at a marketing level that before they were just sort of in panic mode, oh my God, who wrote this book again? Like, so, yeah.
And I just want to make a note, if there's any music managers in the room, labels, we're really lucky in music publishing. We have great collectives in Canada, SOCAN and CMRA. They've invested in technology. They have great matching rates. The majority of money from the streaming services goes out really quickly, and there's billions of transactions being auto-matched and sent out. The problem is that long tail, and it is often a songwriter who's gone into a writing session, has written that great song, and the songwriters in the room don't want to talk about what the splits are on the song. So you can have one songwriter, you can easily have 17 songwriters. Drake has 70 collaborators in Toronto that he writes with. Most of the songs you're hearing are not written by the artists themselves. And when they're not getting paid, it's often that awkwardness about getting the splits negotiated so that they could get the metadata attached. So if you're a music manager or you're a publisher or a label, you need to make sure that's done. And there's some great apps coming out and some great technology to try to have that decision making made in the writing room. But often it comes down to that human intervention of having to actually negotiate the splits.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, there's an education aspect to that too. Like a lot of writers, especially in the pop world, aren't quite as well versed in how, you know, songwriter splits typically work, or, you know, how the process of collecting publishing revenue from both mechanical and public performance. So yeah, I think like the traditional, you know, Nashville is really easy. Everyone just writes their song. They each take their, like, you know, 33% cut if they're working with two other people, and everyone calls in a day and it works pretty well. But I've seen songs with, you know, 15, 20 co-writes, and they're all sharing like varying splits on the song. Someone made the beat for it, so they get a weird split. You know, there's a sample in there too, so you have to track down who actually owns the sample, and, you know, it can get quite complicated very, very quickly. So yeah, that's a good point.
So we're going to look a little bit to the future, look about discoverability and marketing. We know that AI is important. We know the limitations. But where are we going? What are some things you're seeing that are going to make a difference? I was at MeetM, the music conference, a couple weeks ago, and met with an emerging AI company that was looking at how to deal with putting mood and genre and attaching it to music, because there's so much content out there with that sort of metadata attached. And so they were talking to a lot of technology companies about how you use AI to attach that, because, you know, my kids use smart speakers all the time now in the house. And so there's actually a lot of use of playlists that we learned from a company called Edison Research at our Music Tech Summit recently. Is so many people are just defaulting to genres or to playlists, and as a result, it's important to get your work or your recording attached to that playlist. Can you comment on, in your industries, about where we're going and what are some of the bright spots and what the future looks like?
Sure. It's funny that you mentioned the mood edition, because this is something I think that we're thinking about in book publishing. There's two types of, really, really basically, I'm going to break this down. You've got these two types of metadata, right? There's, for discoverability, you have your knowns and your unknowns, right? If you are looking for a book and you know that it's, you know the title, you know the author, I want to buy Educated, it's by Tara Westover, I'm going to go to Amazon and I'm going to type in Educated by Tara Westover and it's going to pop up. That's, you, the searcher, know exactly what you're looking for. But then there's the unknowns. And that goes as basic as, I was having a conversation this morning. Well, I was reading a detective novel. Oh, which one? Ooh, I don't remember. Okay, was the detective a woman or a man? Oh, she was a woman. Oh, right. And then you go from there. You want to be able to get that person. You want them to type in new detective novel, woman character, America? Into Amazon, and you want your book to show up. So that's your unknown. But that ties in with the moods and the direction we're going. Maybe you didn't hear an interview on the CBC with the author of the Louise Penny books. Maybe you are just thinking you might want a dark mystery novel with a woman character, and it's fairly new, and it's set in Sweden. And you, as a book publisher, you want your book that is a dark mystery novel set in Sweden to pop up for that customer. And that's where we're going in a really interesting direction in book publishing, is making sure that, you know, we're pretty solid on the knowns. Let's start working as an industry on the unknowns. The next thing that I think is really interesting and important is accessibility information. So making sure that if you've got an audiobook, that information about how whether or not you can slow it down or speed it up within the app is in there. Is it an ebook that you can use with a screen reader? Is it an ebook that allows you to change the font size or the background color? All of these things are really important, and right now we're not doing a great job of communicating them, so we're losing readers who might be looking for a very specific reading experience. So I think those are the two forward-looking directions that we as an industry are heading in, and I think it's looking very bright.
That's great. That's awesome. From earlier, you might think I'm like a tech cynic or something. I'm actually not. I in the right hands with the right motivation, technology can be an incredibly powerful resource, as long as we're using it to augment what we're trying to do rather than determine what we're going to think and do. So in our platform, we have, you know, the meta tagging just based on category. It's about 550 different categories available to an editor in the tree. Then we have things like mood. Computers do a terrible job of this. With video, you can judge a little bit if you throw a whole bunch of videos into a machine to say, oh, is this, which ones are uplifting, just by the audio, the voice. If there's voices in it, there can be some cues that computers do okay with, but they're not great. Humans are way better at that still. And then we also do what we call the persona mapping of the piece of content. So we use the big five psychological traits and say, if a person was watching this, which type of person would most be interested in this piece of content? So we actually, how Facebook does like the social graph, we do the persona graph. Like, what type of person does this piece of content really potentially appeal to? And then we also do what we call our credibility assessment. So we do an analysis based on 15 different metrics of like how credible is this piece of content. 15 different metrics include, you know, the language is under the bias category. There's three in each one, sorry, I can show it to you at some point. But it's meant to be a thing that an editor, it's still subjective, it's still a human doing this, an editor does a quick evaluation of the credibility score of this piece of content, which in the, most of our partners don't publish this. We work with Let's Talk Science, they do publish that on their page or on their channels that we provide for them, because it's meant to be lifting critical thinking among the audience. We're not meant to be prescriptive in saying give it a little check mark that it's credible, but it's meant to show, you know, it's scoring low on bias, so just pay attention. It's okay, you can have some chocolate in your diet, you know, but just pay attention to that facet as you're watching it. So we use all those as signals for our machine learning. So you might have thought, okay, you're doing persona, so you're just going to give people what they like. Yes and no. So what we do is we've created what we call the bias spread in our algorithm, our tool. So it will, as an end user, if I go to our page right now, we've got a little bot that shows up at the bottom, or if you go to our Facebook page, you can sign up for it. The Facebook one does a little bit more intensely because we were just playing with Facebook when we were doing it. But it starts to get a sense of who you are as an end user or an information consumer, and it sends you every day two videos that it thinks you will like that are aligned directly with your persona. And then the third one is meant to challenge you slightly outside your comfort zone. Not like the complete opposite of your point of view when it comes to gun control or something like that, but something that would be an entry way for you to get into a slightly different perspective or position on an issue. So we can use that at like within our site, and then CTV News is going to be using that as well to get people to engineer serendipity back into the discovery of their own content. So you might get a couple of pieces because you've told our system through them that you're interested in politics and international geopolitics or something like that, and your behavior has suggested that is actually what your interests are, then it's going to start to like maybe nudge you towards something from TSN, which is also part of the Bell Media universe, to expose you to stuff that you otherwise might not have even known that you're interested in. Because essentially what we're doing is automating what in the broadcast world we call the lineup producers function. So when you go and watch the evening news, somebody's job is to actually figure out how do I get people to watch this challenging story. It's very important for democracies that we watch challenging stories. You know? But how do I get somebody to actually pay attention and watch this thing if it's very off-putting as a topic? So it's actually somebody's job to craft the lineup of the hour to do that. In the digital space, there's no function like that. So how do we make sure that in a functioning democracy, we're exposed to not just the stuff that we like, but the things that are going to expose new ideas to us or serendipitously expose us to something we didn't even know we cared about? This is what we're trying to use the technology for, because it doesn't just have to serve ads.
So where are we going on music that you're excited about, Tom?
Excited about a lot of things. I joined the music industry like coming straight out of college during the financial crash. So to me, the music industry is in a great spot. I mean, I'm excited that for the first time in a long time, it seems like tech companies, music publishers, record labels all kind of understand that, you know, everyone wins in the long run if there's a bit of shared respect and you know, everyone works together to, try and grow both the music side of the business as well as the tech platforms that rely on music for their products and their services. So I'm excited for discoverability in the way that, you know, I think metadata is going to only become more important, especially mood-based metadata with smart speakers. We kind of started entering that space a little while ago in our production music libraries. Like our one of our companies, Jingle Punks, has a library of production music. It's about 500,000 tracks that you can go through and select to use in your TV productions and whatnot. But the way that their database that you can search works is they also have mood-based metadata. So, you know, you can search for, you know, scary, you know, up-tempo. You can search for other movies or TV shows, and you'll get songs that sound like the music used in those TV shows. So stuff like that is going to become more important, I think, on the smart speaker side of things. So that same type of tagging of mood-based metadata, of alternative metadata, is going to, you know, I think, become more important. I'm also pretty optimistic about the new standards for data being rolled out across the music industry. You know, the Music Modernization Act just passed recently.
That's a U.S.-based legislation.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah. When I talk about music, it's usually centered in the U.S., but Canada plays a very important role as well. but yeah, so the Music Modernization Act, the Mechanical Licensing Collective, and the DDEC standards that are being implemented across, you know, the entire ecosystem, I think will be really important. I think getting the music business to a spot where everyone's communicating better and being more transparent is going to be really important. I think in the past, the music business hasn't been the best at transparency, but really I feel like the more transparent the industry gets, the more trust, you know, it'll win back. People are paying for music again a lot more. Piracy's down significantly. It's easier to access music than ever before. You know, I don't have a problem paying $9.99 a month to get basically access to whatever I want. And yeah, I think, you know, there's great music coming in from a million different independent labels, major labels. You know, it's a really good ecosystem right now. So there's problems, and there'll always be problems. But yeah, I'm pretty optimistic about the music industry in general.
And just a comment on the Music Modernization Act. It's a U.S. solution to something we already do really well in Canada. So
yeah, we're great.
So I think we're ready to take some questions from the audience. So we have some mics coming around. Anyone? Back corner. And if you want to direct towards one of the panelists, please do. Sorry, we can't hear.
I think the microphone might need to be on.
Yeah.
Okay.
Perfect.
Ooh. Okay, I'm here. So mainly to Tessa, just because I'm also an independent video producer and I do interactive digital design. For the indie, what kind of free tools, if we can't yet afford to come and hire you because we haven't got our funding, what can we use? Things like Wikipedia and IMDb, are those things that will get us into the metadata environment, and are there other things like that?
I would definitely look at those and make sure that you've got whoever has commissioned you to do the thing or whomever's, make sure that they have, if they've got standards, that you're following them, and then yes, absolutely go to that. And Google Card too is also a really important thing to learn about. This is the Google search engine just lives off of the data that has been entered, and Google Cards are the things that follow video content around on the web and are interpreted by Google. So if you're relying on search in any capacity, that's a good place to make sure that you know that your stuff is tagged to be optimized there. I'm sorry, I don't really work too much in the independent space, but I would look at those three things for sure.
Next.
Thanks for putting this together. This is really interesting to me. My name is Mike Rocha. I work with Eggplant Music and Sound, and I work in music supervision and music licensing. I have so many questions I could ask, but let me start with this one, which is, are content creators, our composers in our case, getting paid? And the scenario I'll put in place is one which I've seen proliferating a lot more, which is subscription-based blanket music licensing for short-form digital content. This looks like $15 a month subscription where you get access to tons of production music if I'm a YouTube content creator creating short form. Artlist.io is one of them. Soundstripe is another one. Musicbed is another one. They're obviously going after the long tail economic, you know, Spotify type economic model, Netflix model. Now, you've got the content creator that wants the music on one point of this triangle. You've got the content, so you've got the composer creating this product. And then you've usually got somewhat of a licensing rep that's acting as this catalog from which this $15 a month is allowing the user access. How is that transaction monitored? I know metadata has to be key in that, because now you've got one piece of music that's going to how many different places, on how many different streaming platforms, assuming it's just streaming platforms. Mm-hmm. How does that composer at the end of the day know that they're reliably getting paid the amount of money that they're deserved, and the metadata isn't getting retranslated, or a simple typo is meeting its, their money's ending up in a slush fund in South Africa and we don't know how to get to it? These are real scenarios we're looking at.
Yep.
So, yeah, I'd love to just hear your thoughts on that.
Great question, and loaded like like crazy. Yeah, so it's very complicated. Like, obviously, the blanket fee that's being charged should be flowing back to the composer as well. So, you know, your blanket fee will cover, you know, depending on the contract, will cover whatever services or platforms that that blanket will cover. And then from there, though, especially at the public performance organizations and societies around the world, you're right, there is a, you know, you do need to have strong metadata and a strong data chain to ensure that those people are being paid appropriately.
But if there's been a buyout at the front, you as a composer are not getting paid, and so you need to be very careful about putting your compositions into those libraries. The most successful composers are the ones who are licensing up front, but then are also in the back end getting their money from SOCAN or in other international PROs. And there's a real problem now with that model being challenged. And so it's something for composers to watch when they're entering into those libraries.
It's definitely difficult across all the various platforms now, too, and especially when you get into, you know, UGC platforms, especially YouTube and Facebook. I know for us, we, you know, when we're doing a blanket license, or we do a blanket license with, you know, on YouTube, if we do a blanket with an MCN, they may have 100,000 creators that may get to use a certain piece of music. So, you know, one piece of music could potentially be used in, you know, 100,000 videos. So it's important for us to make sure that our music library and our copyrights are claimed within, you know, the various digital services, but also accurately claimed and registered at, you know, every PRO and sub-publisher in our own systems. So in theory, you know, when it's all being reported, it should be linked back. But if there's a break in that linkage at that digital platform, you know, they're not sending reporting, or it's not claimed properly, or it's only claimed in certain territories, like, there's definitely a huge amount of ways that that revenue can get tied up and can end up in black boxes, or, well, not black boxes, but could be tied up in a ton of different ways. So it's a hard question to answer without getting, like, super far into the weeds, but basically it's ensure that your repertoire is registered correctly at source, wherever it's being licensed, and then that...
Or sign with a music publisher who can make sure that yeah. happens.
Yeah, very important too.
There was a question up here.
Yeah, maybe you guys were I came in late when you were talking about the ISRC codes.
Now, containing to that metadata, that's locked in as soon as you register with an ISRC code. And going back to music publishers and the PRO companies, you see a lot of that data being collected, and you're now seeing integration from a lot of these side tech companies coming in and offering their services for they're like, I guess you can, I would look at them like Roombas that come in and they sweep and they come in and they get all that data and they funnel it into the different places where it needs to go. Now with that, can, maybe I missed it, but do you have any of the names for these companies that offer those services that, you know, CMRRA uses or SOCAN uses, that you can get that information that plays all the statistics back?
You mean like ISRC code, or more like you know, stream counts, view counts, that type of thing? Which
yes, stream counts or view counts or
yeah. Radio plays. So Nielsen's a big one.
But there is also these other ones that are coming in for music publishers that give you access to that data. They're almost like.
Yep.
Yeah, so you're already getting data back from CMRA and SOCAN, quite transparency on number of plays. Some of our companies, though, do go to Nielsen and other companies because they want the real-time data. They want to know today, tomorrow, what happened today. So there's a few of those different companies. And even within the YouTube system, yeah. Olay yeah. or Anthem uses their CMS.
Yeah, so a lot of the digital platforms are rolling out their own real-time analytics system. So I know, you know, YouTube has always had a very, very robust analytics platform that lets you basically pull real-time data for your catalog, and they have like crazy, crazy metrics, you know, that you can find out geographically where your content is very popular. You can find out on what devices, time frames, all kinds of stuff. So it's super robust. But I know that Spotify is working on the same thing. I would imagine Apple would roll out something similar. And yeah, I can only see that being more popular. So again, we pull a lot of our data directly at source from digital companies, but again, like Nielsen for real-time data we use.
And Nielsen just announced 2 weeks ago that they would have more country-specific data, like 26 more countries for YouTube data that they would be incorporating into their service.
Can I just add a voice of doom to that?
Yeah.
Having been through this with the media industry, there's a company called Chartbeat, which does data analytics of information content and how it's performing. And if you go, I guarantee you, if you go into any newsroom, particularly newspaper organizations, we're particularly, it's a great company. They have great data, but it becomes problematic when that starts to define the content that the creators are actually creating. So if you go into a newsroom, you'll see a big Chartbeat screen probably looking right over the city desk where you can see which article is actually trending right now, what's gone fast. And that's like led to a whole lot of terrible stuff in the industry, like clickbait and that kind of stuff. So it's just as a voice of caution around, like, data is fantastic, but do not let it define the content that you make.
Mm-hmm. And I've seen some of our companies that they get so addicted to looking at the data every day that they're actually wasting a lot of time. They log on to the YouTube CMS is the first thing they do every morning with their coffee. But what happens when Facebook rolls out their system in 3 years, which they're planning to do, and the next one, and the next one? We're starting to have small entrepreneurs that are just getting overwhelmed by just trying to deal with the data, and they're not dealing with getting good data in there.
Hi, morning. Laura Lee from Digital 55. Thank you so much for the conversation and the information. Nerding out a bit on data, and I love it. And actually, that's a good segue into my question. So I'm just wondering, because data is obviously data, and it is sort of quantitative, but there's also a storytelling aspect, which I really think you spoke to on during this conversation about sort of human-centered data and human-centered designing data. So how do you think that's going to iterate and change as data has to get more sophisticated once you have the foundational pieces? And so my company is digital. We do interactive digital media for clients. We also do content for our company as well, but creating custom content. So we're always thinking human-centered in terms of the assets that were created, and how do you think that's going to change in data in terms of not just telling the data quantitative story, but also that qualitative story? And I think you spoke to it a bit, but in terms of looking a little bit forward, how do you think that's going to keep iterating?
That's a very interesting question. I do think that as systems get better at parsing information, we will see more. Again, I'm thinking about book publishing, where we have a very specific standard that we send out our metadata in, and I think we will be able to see more long-form pieces of data that then a system is allowed to parse. So rather than just a list of keywords, I think that we're going to find ourselves in a place where we might be able to write out an entire paragraph about how this book might make you feel. And then a system is going to be able to figure out how to parse that in a way that you would search. This is so far into the future. This is just a beautiful dream. But I think you're right that we're going to find a way to make data tell a story in a way that a system can then spit back out to a human. And it'll be a while before we get there, but we'll be around then, surely.
On the music side, I think there'll be more opportunity to have better AI and better algorithms. Right now, you know, they're still pretty messy, and I could see in the future algorithmic playlists being maybe a little more heavy-handed, like with manual moderation and with human interaction. Like, I know Apple, for example, is very, very active with like a human playlist, human curated playlist, where Spotify is like very heavy on the algorithm side. So, I think it's hard. Yeah, right. I think the technology is so new right now, it's maybe not perfect with what it's recommending you. But I think as that improves and potentially, you know, expands, yeah, I'm kind of hopeful that these systems will be able to take a bit better or a bigger data set and then whittle it down to be a little more relevant to people. And it won't just be like, oh, you clicked on this, you also visited these web pages, you're surely going to like this content too. So, which seems to be what it is in a lot of ways right now, especially on the big user-generated platforms. So, yeah, I'm hopeful for better technology and possibly AI being able to help there, machine learning as well. But I think it's going to take some time to get to that point, yeah.
I'm deeply hopeful around this stuff. I think that's the space that I actually see the biggest opportunity. And I see that, you know, so long as we can take the advertising revenue motivation side and companies like mine can kind of enter at it with that not being our focus. And the companies that we work with, yes, that is a focus of theirs, but we can just help enable them to do a much better job of getting important information to people at the right time when they need it. And that, like, I envision a world where, like, there could be a Fitbit for information diet, you know, where it's not prescriptive saying, oh, you haven't looked at enough about blah, blah, whatever the subject is, but you as an end consumer enabling people to have a much better understanding of their, what they're seeing, the information that they're taking in, and how it's getting to them. There's another phenomenon that's happening in the AI industry in particular called explainable AI, and I'm a huge advocate of that as well. The more that we can, particularly from news and information media organizations, the more that they can see themselves playing a really critical role in enabling citizens to understand how these systems work and why they're getting this piece of information to them is huge. And enabling citizens to actually have more proactive control over the data that they're supplying into these systems as well. I'm a big advocate of things like the personal data record being something that is owned by an individual, not by the companies that facilitate the exchange of information within their platforms, but you own from any interactions that you have with your device, you own how you're interacting with it, and you can even bestow that into future generations. I have no idea what that means. But I think that it's so powerful for us to be having those conversations now instead of saying, oh, well, it's just technology. It's happening over there outside of me. We have to have it be human-led.
And I think, and there's a whole other panel here, Aaron, is we need to be looking what's happening in the broadcast and telecom review that's happening in Ottawa over the next couple of years, because all of these things are being discussed and what Canada decides to do. I would say that people are getting paid on the music side in Canada much better than they are in the U.S. So a lot of what you read in the press about lawsuits and people not getting paid is a U.S. thing. There are still challenges, but songwriters and publishers are getting paid in Canada. So just make sure that you always in the news are deciphering what's specific to Canada versus the rest of the world. So thank you, everybody. I think the panelists are going to be hanging around for a few minutes if you'd like to chat with them one-on-one. Thank you.